April 2nd, and welcome everybody. I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2390. And
thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2390, I'll direct your attention to the dash two amendments which you have at your seat because they do completely replace the original measure. The dash two amendments authorize the Department of Transportation to issue customized registration plates per Congressional Medal of Honor recipients. It directs the department to create a customized plate with a unique background design, configuration, image of the medal, and containing the words Medal of Honor. It authorizes the department to issue one set of registration plates to Medal of Honor recipients. It requires the recipient to remove the plates if the vehicle is sold or destroyed. It prohibits the registration plates from being used on any other motor vehicle except if the registration plates are transferred through the department to another vehicle owned by the recipient. It requires the department to cancel any Medal of Honor registration plates if the department determines that the vehicle is owned by a person that does not qualify. And it finally allows the department to promulgate rules to implement this measure. We do have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact received on specifically the dash two amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. We had some guests that were coming in to speak on this bill. I'm going to go ahead and ask Jack Evans if he would just come up and give us a little overview and while we wait. And
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. As you recall, we had initially attempted to get a plate going for the Medal of Honor recipient based on the group plate program, and that would have required some programming and some other costs, and we were asking for an appropriation out of the general fund. Since that time, the speaker approached us and asked that we revisit that and look at perhaps doing something that would not involve programming, and suggest that we might take a look at the vanity plate or the custom plate program, which we typically have never done before. DMV did take a look at this and determined that they could produce a plate with a unique background, and that it would, if it followed closely the custom plate guidelines, that we could do this without essentially any additional costs. So what this will do will allow this plate to be produced on a unique background as a custom plate. And I have a mock-up of it here. I know I had it upside down. Sorry about that. And what that will do is you'll see it's on a separate background. It has a digital image of the Medal of Honor, and that is specific to the Army in that instance. Because it's digital, we can reproduce it in the medal that's specific to the branch of service of the recipient. And this works since we have only one recipient and anticipate having very few recipients in this category. Hence, we're able to use this category. The plates will be issued with a specific configuration. That one, I believe, has CMH1, which Mr. Maxwell currently has on his plate right now, on his vanity plate. And we'll ask him if he wants to use that configuration or perhaps MOH1. The plate will, as I mentioned, contain an image of the medal. And it can be transferred to another vehicle owned by the recipient. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and invite up Speaker Merkley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think you may have just essentially received testimony similar to what I'm about to say, so I'll be brief.
Go ahead.
And if it's in contradiction, then my apologies. But essentially, I just wanted to share with you my brief involvement in this evolving story, which is that I asked the Department of Motor Vehicles isn't there a better solution than programming a brand new plate into the computers? When you have already a custom plate system, why can't we just add something like CMH, Congressional Medal of Honor, or some other thing, call that, plug that into the custom plate system, thereby not have to do new programming? And so I asked them to take a look at that and explore any other ways that they could avoid the reprogramming, therefore the extensive costs of adding a new plate into the computer. And they came back and said, essentially, as I understand it from the memo that I have from Tom McClellan, that yes, they can do that. They explored a number of issues. One was whether they could make this a permanent plate. You can see that because of the programming issues and plugging it into the custom plates, they weren't able to do that unless there's new information since I spoke with them. And there still are some costs that they have listed in terms of legal reviews and administrative rules and so forth, overhead, but not the type of programming costs they had previously. And I think that has helped reduce this to kind of this is the practical type of solution rather than kind of just sticking with it's a new plate, let's get a new category. So I wanted to commend them for working on this idea. And if it works and it meets your all's review, and then I think it would be a very nice way to proceed while minimizing the cost to the public and delivering the same practical effect, which is honoring our Congressional Medal of Honor recipients.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably a question for, not for Speaker Merkley, but probably for Jack. This unique background is probably a silkscreen process. He didn't testify to that, but I'm assuming that that's what it is. And the Congressional Medal of Honor plate, which we have, I think has silkscreened the actual medal itself onto the plate. My question was, number one, what's the estimated cost in doing that? And number two, will we be doing other kinds of silkscreening of other objects onto custom plates in the future, or is this limited to this one House bill?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, this is, I'm not sure if it's silkscreening, but it is a similar kind of a process on a backing material, a sheeting, that carries the color and the artwork, and that's then pressed on the plate. And that's digital, so that's why this image of the Medal of Honor can be changed so easily. And the cost to do that is incidental. The vendor does this for us in developing configuration, so it's really not a cost that we can record. The other costs that were mentioned, by the way, involving Attorney General review, the Attorney General's office has been so intimately involved with us so far in this project that's really not a cost that we have to worry about anymore. Your second question was about using this for other plates, using this as a vehicle for other kinds of plates. We envision this as exclusively for the Medal of Honor plate, using this program, because it's limited to one individual or perhaps several individuals, but we'll be able to protect the series of configurations, CMH 1 through whatever, or MOH 1 through 9 or whatever it is. If we were to do it with other plates, then it gets tricky, and then we get into other situations, and then we get into that old issue of proliferating license plates, and we want to be careful about that.
So, Madam Chair, follow up. If someone caught wind of this testimony today and asked for their fleet to have CMH 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 for a fleet of a company with initials CMH or COH, then you wouldn't honor those requests for that vanity plate.
Chair by Representative Butler, that's correct. That configuration is protected.
Thank you. I just wanted to confirm that.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair. We're in a work session, are we not?
Yes, we are.
Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-26-07 to House Bill 2390.
Thank you. I'm way ahead of myself here. Representative Butler moves the Dash
2
amendments to dated, boy, I don't even have them sitting in front of me, dated 3-26-07 to House Bill 2390. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, just make a comment to thank the Speaker for stepping in. Representative Escobar, I think, did a tremendous job of keeping focus on this issue and just a kind of bulldogged desire to make sure that we got this done to honor our Medal of Honor recipient. And I really appreciate the Speaker stepping forward with a creative solution. And I hope this sets a precedent with other bills that I co-sponsor that the Speaker will step in and solve them for me and get them passed. So.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I would also add to my motion, I noticed that previously we had a Ways and Means subsequent referral, and now there is no, the testimony is there is no referral, right, or need to refer to Ways and Means. So that we, of course, my motion right now is just to add the Dash 2 amendments, but I would like to have us consider not having this go to Ways and Means when we move the bill.
Thank you. So the Dash 2 amendments have been moved. And any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2390 be engrossed, engrossed for the Dash 2 amendments, that it be moved to the House floor with a due pass motion or a recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be removed therefrom so that it may move to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2390 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Representative Buckley.
Very hard with the other one. Thank you, Madam Chair.
My son, Buckley Butler.
That's right. No, my only comment is to thank the representative for his motion and to not send us to Ways and Means, and also just again to tip my hat to Representative Escobar for all his work on this and to the Speaker as well.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2390 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye.
I like that.
And for the record, Representative Reed and Representative Tomei are excused. And thank you.
And will Representative Escobar carry it?
Yes.
The Speaker, or?
Could we offer it to Representative Escobar?
I think we should offer it to Representative Escobar. Thank you. All right. Motion carries. And I close the work session, House Bill 2390. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3527.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, for your attention. Committee members, I'm bringing forward a very exciting bill today on behalf of a very unique car manufacturer who is operating in Southern Oregon now, Brammo Motorsports. The proposal is to create a new type of vehicle registration For the record, my name is Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson Counties, to make sure that that's on the record. I first heard of Bramah Motorsports just through an article in the local newspapers, a mention of that this manufacturer was starting to work in Ashland, and I wasn't actually aware quite of what the extent of the work of the company was until about 6 months ago or so, when a representative from the governor's office contacted me and said, you know, you really have to check these guys out. They're right there in your hometown. You really have to go see what they're doing and what their plans are for the future. And I went over to the factory that they have on Tolman Creek Road in Ashland, and I was just amazed by what I found there, level of activity and level of creativity that the Bramah Motorsports is bringing to their field. I brought before you the presentation that they did for ODOT when they brought this idea forward. To give a brief, just a very brief explanation, Bramah is a very visionary company with a tremendous energy to it, tremendous creativity to it. They have begun with a kind of calling card car, the Ariel Atom, which is a replica of a sports racing car that is manufactured in the United Kingdom. And as you can see from the photos in front of you, it's an outstanding-looking car. It's a beautiful car. The owner of the company is he's a force of nature type of person. He came up to Ashland intending to retire and to work on vehicles as more or less of a hobby. But as he threw his energies into this, he started to see that he could actually produce cars and perhaps sell them as part of what he was doing as a hobby. And the kind of uniqueness of the vehicles and the attractiveness of the vehicles got attention fairly quickly after he went into production. Jay Leno found one somehow. I'm not quite sure how that story went, but so Jay Leno bought one of these replicas. These are handmade vehicles. They've been described as everything from a four-wheeled motorcycle, but it's much more than that. It's a great tubular vehicle, a great sporty look to it, and just it looks like fun. When you look at it, it looks like fun. So the gentleman went into production with a handful of employees, hand-making these vehicles in the factory in Ashland, and he has continued to expand every month that he's been in operation. And it's not just, Bramah's not just about this vehicle. This is kind of, like I said, their lead vehicle. If I remember correctly, these sell for about $85,000, you know, unless you want it modified, you know, to your personal specs. And he is using that money as he sells his vehicles to invest in this company, which now has over 60 employees in Ashland, paying very good wages. And he has hired a team of designers, young designers, to follow up on a series of vehicles, including an electric motorcycle that is in process, including a four-seat clean energy vehicle that is on the drawing boards as well now. And these young designers, when you go into the factory in Ashland, they have their designs all around the walls, you're looking at the vehicles of the future. You're looking at these wonderful, attractive, economical, they will be, and clean energy vehicles, and you just can't help but feel that you're looking at something fantastic that's evolving for our state with Bramah Motorsports. So the company, as they've moved into production, they've found such a demand for these vehicles, they ran into a snag in that right now in Oregon statutes, there's no definition of this vehicle. As you can see in the presentation, currently we do register kit cars and other replicas, but this vehicle does not fit in comfortably to any category that we currently allow registration for. And in order to develop these cars and to sell these cars in our state, we need to try to address that issue. How do we register these vehicles? How do we make it possible for people to come to our state to tour the factory and to do a test drive on these vehicles, given that we do not have a category for these for registration? So we brought this a challenge to the Department of Transportation, and Jack Evans and DMV have been fantastic in terms of trying to work through step by step by step every issue involved with what it would mean to register these vehicles to address the desire of the company to be able to have their customers test drive this and to have people who buy them safely transport them from home to a track for to race them on a track if they care to and back again, or from home to their mechanic. How can we do this and satisfy the requirements of safety and satisfy the legal requirements for this vehicle? So I thank ODOT and the DMV for their persistence in addressing this and really trying to go after every angle of it. We do have a representative here from Bremen Motorsports this afternoon. If you care to ask any particular questions about the company or about the vehicle, he would be glad to answer them. I appreciate your consideration of this bill. It would be tremendously positive for Bramo to be able to work through this and be able to continue to sell these vehicles and all the other different kind of vehicles that they are currently developing from their factory in Ashland. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that I can. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, we'll have an opportunity to hear from the Bramo folks so that we can ask questions relative to the
certainly.
Some of the safety aspects that ODOT is certainly probably going to be concerned about.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention to the committee. We will have a dash two amendment for this bill. What you have before you today, we found out very late in the day that there are a couple changes we have to make to the language to make it work. So we will be bringing it dash two.
Thank you. Representative Buckley, would you like to introduce your guest since he actually has not signed up?
Oh.
And I don't have a name.
That's okay. Or did you want to hear from Jack Evans as well?
Yes, I do want Jack Evans. I don't know if you want
him.
Okay.
Absolutely.
If you both come up.
And state your name for the record. Jack, want to come up here?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Joe Wissman. I'm the Director of Operations of Bramo Motorsports.
Welcome. Okay. Do you have anything to add to what Representative Buckley said, or are you just here for questions?
Well, I'll be glad to answer any questions. I might provide you some background. The car initiated in Great Britain. It is seen as what's known as a track day car. The British recognize that genre of vehicle like we would recognize a recreational vehicle. For instance, on the highways, you will often see Grandma and Grandpa piloting this large bus-like instrument down our highways, and you give them wide berth because you recognize it as a recreational vehicle and that Grandma and Grandpa might not be expert drivers at a vehicle like that, of that nature. So they recognize this and have a class for it called a special vehicle exemption. They inspect the vehicle, make sure it's safe for the highways, and what they anticipate is that the gentleman will be driving his car on the weekends to the track, racing it on the track, driving it home, and perhaps out to the country for a picnic. They do not expect to see it in his parking space in downtown London on a business day. And so they recognize it. Once again, we don't have a class in our country that recognizes that. And I appreciate the efforts of ODOT and Representative Buckley to bring this perhaps to fruition.
Thank you. Representative, did you have a question?
I do. I would like testimony from Jack, as well.
First. All right.
Thank you.
Please. Go ahead, Jack.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. Speaking of House Bill 3527, and what this does is define racing activity vehicle in the vehicle code, creates this new definition for the purpose of titling and registration, and it exempts these vehicles from the typical equipment standards and from emissions testing by DEQ, where there is DEQ boundary. Since these vehicles are identified by a product information number rather than a vehicle information number, the bill allows the vehicles to be titled with that PIN. We expect there to be a small number of these vehicles on the highway, and as Representative Buckley had indicated, there are some amendments that we were unable to get into the original bill that we were looking to add that are still need to be tweaked a bit. And those will deal with the limitations on driving these vehicles. These are our track day vehicles, as was mentioned, and the intent is to drive essentially from your home to a racetrack and then use them on the racetrack. And we have set up a number of points. We're looking to have a permanent registration on the vehicle. Once it's registered, it's subject to special provisions, and all these will be spelled out in the amendments. You could drive it in exhibitions, parades, club activities, those types of things, like a special interest vehicle, or from home to the racetrack, and we've specified a 90-mile radius from home to an existing racetrack, or test drive it in a 30-mile radius of the place where it's manufactured or maintained. And we've also specified not to be on highways with speeds in excess of 55 miles an hour. So these are the kind of restrictions that we all were asking be placed in the statutes with respect to this vehicle. And those will be coming. We had anticipated today, but there were a few issues.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Sure, if I may. I think this question goes to Joe. First of all, have a number of vehicle recalls on a regular basis worldwide as a result of most anything. Injection systems, brakes, where the gas tanks are located, how they're connected up. Any of those kinds of concerns with regard to and those were mostly safety related. Mm-hmm. Any of those kinds of concerns relative to the Brownell Motorsports racing vehicle activity?
Absolutely. As a small manufacturer, under 500 vehicles a year, we are excused from reporting any of those things. But, you know, as a morally responsible company, you know, we follow up on them. We had 16 escapes from the factory last year, minor escapes, but we tracked everyone down to a customer and sent him the fix kit, you know, your left turn signal doesn't work, that kind of thing. So we keep a track on all the cars that are out there. It's a fun product, but you know, it's they drive it on a racetrack and they drive it at the limits of the machine and the operator, and so we have to make sure it's safe, and we track all of that. We have a effectivity chart that we keep whenever we change the product in any way, and we have about 60 changes right now to the product over time. All of them improvements. Our motto is continuous improvement. And so, yes, sir, we do track that.
Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
16 recalls, under 500 total vehicles. That 16 is out of how many vehicles were manufactured?
It's 16 different events.
Events.
You know, in terms of, you know, a screw being loose, or replace this with this kind of a gasket and that kind of a thing.
So if I could just get a clarification,
yeah.
is that model-wide then that
yes,
the
yes,
16 issues affects all vehicles that have been produced?
Right. During a particular period of time, we use this kind of a washer. Hey, it needs to be replaced with this kind of a washer.
Okay. Follow-up and then
yes.
question, additional uh-huh. question. Jack, the issues of being exempt from equipment and safety standards as well as DEQ standards, does the department have any angst about a piece of equipment being exempted from safety standards?
Chair, by our representative Butler, certainly, but with this small number of vehicles that we anticipate and with the restrictions on the driving of these vehicles, we don't have a particular problem with this. We're allowed to be neutral on this without coming out against it. So, yeah, we don't have a problem with that.
Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Jack, I guess I've got a concern. It's a DEQ concern. That's not really something that you need to address, but those folks are concerned about changes in future releases of lawnmower engines. And while there's a lot of lawnmower engines out there, they're tightening up on them because those little few horsepower lawnmower engines are creating more problem for environmental quality. I guess, I don't know what the horsepower is here, but if it was 100 horsepower and I'm doing 500 of them a year, then that's 50,000 horsepower as compared to that many lawnmowers. The DEQ issues is anyone signed up or expressed any concern relative to the environmental quality issues?
Chair, by Representative Butler, it's my understanding that the DEQ and the governor's office have taken a look at the vehicle, and that because of the extremely small numbers of these things that would be out there, it hasn't risen to the level of concern.
And a follow-up question, if I may, to Jack. Jack, license plates to be issued for these kinds of vehicles. I don't see a single one of the exhibits with a license plate. I assume that in this process of having a racing activity vehicle for the purpose of license or for the purpose of titling and registration, somewhere a license will be involved.
Chair, by Representative Butler, that's correct. And that's one of the issues that we're addressing in the amendment, and that's one of the reasons the amendment isn't here today. We had anticipated a special interest license plate for these with permanent registration, but it appears that it was implied, at least, that it would have regular registration plates. So we're tweaking that, and we'll be back with those amendments. But, yes, it will be registered, and we'll have license plates.
So just a clarification, if we're using regular license plates and those have been reserved for that equipment, which is meets the safety standards and the equipment standards and those kinds of things, the tweak, you're not talking about a new kind of license plate, but certainly a new kind of registration.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that's correct. It is not a new license plate. It's a new definition for the registration.
Okay, now, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Smith would ask this question if he were here. He's a Ways and Means wonk, too, and one of the concerns he would have is, wait a minute, if it's $50,000 to create a new license plate for, fill in the blank, what's the additional new cost here, Jack?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, the cost to implement this and to change the database is approximately $24,000. And that includes some programming and changes to the rules that address this and the registration and those types of standard startup costs.
And now a question, if I may, for Joe Listman, please, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Joe, the kind of horsepower that these generate?
We start at 205 horsepower and go up to 300 horsepower.
And so if I could follow up then, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to guess that these aren't the kinds of cars that Grandma would drive to church on Sunday, that these are the kind of cars that probably could generate speeds at this apparent weight and size, that this is a vehicle which could generate a couple hundred miles an hour. Is that 150, 160 miles an hour? Is that out of the realm for this piece of equipment?
No, Representative, to both questions. Grandma would not drive it to church on Sunday, and the top speed on the vehicle is about 135 miles an hour. What happens to you is because it's so open, the wind resistance just, it gets in there and overcomes it. So the top speed is really not much more than you're going to find on other production cars. The acceleration to get there, though, is real quick.
So I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
And this is just a concern of what happened when I took my, and this goes back a long, long time ago. It's probably 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, when I drove down and got my driver or my motorcycle license and had a three-wheeler and said, it's got a horn, it's got a windshield, it's got lights, it's got brakes, it's got backup, it's got all of the various kinds of things. They said, this isn't in the code, therefore you can't have a license. And I said, well, at a minimum, it ought to have a motorcycle license so that I can drive it from one farm to the other. This was back one of the very first three-wheelers that we had back in those days. My concern is that the DMV felt like it was extremely important that I have a windshield and I have the lights and I had the other kinds of things. For a vehicle that could go 135 miles an hour, I could get 30 miles an hour going downhill, falling off a cliff in my three-wheeler. But for a vehicle that goes this speed, you don't have those kinds of concerns, Jack, in the DMV?
Chair, by our Representative Butler, we would have great concern if it were going 135 miles an hour on streets or roads or highways. But as a track vehicle, we're assuming that the person's going to have a crash helmet and goggles and whatever they have. And I actually have seen pictures with small wind deflection devices. But for the, that is one of the exemptions does address windshields, because when we were putting this together, we looked at the pictures of it and got some information from Bramo. You can get these without windshields. So at the lower speeds, that would be an issue that the driver would have to take care of. Going under 55 miles an hour, they'd still want to have some type of eye protection for sure.
And Madam Chair, please, none of my questions have been aimed at trying to discourage this activity. I think this is in the entrepreneurial spirit that is and belongs to Oregon, and particularly Southern Oregon. And so I think that this is a good thing. My question will be to the DMV, if we start here, where do we go? Do we encourage then Brahma Motorsports LLC 2 and 3 and 4, and I hope we do. I hope that the same folks spin off and have one and have a plant in addition to Southern Oregon, might have one in Bend and might have one somewhere else, and maybe three more plants in addition to those. My concern is that if each one of those plants then can generate up to 500 cars per year with the exemption, what's the total capacity that the system has to, I guess one of the questions I'm asking is about racetracks. These are going to and from racetracks within 90 miles, and of course, being in southeastern Oregon, 90 miles will get you about to the next town, or maybe between there and the next gas station at 135 miles an hour, but my concern is just, what's the capacity for our highways for these based upon the numbers of raceway activities that we have in Oregon? Are there a lot of maybe I'm missing that. Are there a lot of race events where these will be raced in Oregon and within 30 miles of the manufacturing point, places where they can be easily driven?
Chair, by Representative Butler, I really can't answer the question about the number of racetracks, and the figure is 90 miles from home to racetrack. And but I know there are in the Ashland area, there are some racetracks down there, and there are up in Multnomah. I really don't have a handle on how far or how many communities have them within 90 miles. We were trying to put some limits on how far these vehicles get driven. So if someone were to live in Lincoln
Ontario.
City,
Ontario,
Oregon, and there was not a racetrack within 90 miles, they wanted to race this vehicle, they would have to put it up on a trailer and bring it in.
Thank you. That is of concern, and I guess then when a test driver wants to come and test drive one, there must be a, because he's not going to want to test drive it at 20 to 35 miles an hour through a residential neighborhood unless it's Bill Cosby and needs to blow the gunk out, in which case I think he said that's where he took his Ferrari to blow the gunk out, was in the residential neighborhoods back. But my concern is, from the, and I'm sorry, I really don't know the answer to this question, and I should. from the Bromo Motorsports, is it within 30 miles to a racetrack so that they can go and drive one 100 miles an hour and test?
Representative, if it needs to be tested at that speed, then you would go to the track and test it. And if you need to trailer it to the track, then that's what we would do. And we do trailer them to a track now for testing. You don't need to go 100 miles an hour to test the car. You can take it within legal speed limits. And what you generally want is to get it up to speed, let's say 50 miles an hour, and perhaps apply the brakes aggressively, you know, without worrying about somebody on your tail. And so that's why we would add the amendment to it that allows for maintenance. And we would expect that to be done responsibly, just like mechanics do with your car when they maintain it and then take it out for a test drive. When they say they've test driven it, if they've fixed the brakes, then they've applied them aggressively, probably in a safe manner.
Final question,
yeah.
And I don't know anything about these kinds of cars. It looks like this car has a very low center of gravity, and in that regard would be very safe, I would think. There's, I think, something called a Bernoulli effect. Is that something that plays into the construction of this particular vehicle?
Yes, sir. Good observation. It does have a very low center of gravity. In 4 years of operation in Europe, no one has ever flipped this vehicle.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I have a couple. Kind of a follow-up on one of Representative Butler's questions, and that was, how are you getting these to the track now? I'm assuming trailering them.
Yes, ma'am.
And how many do you think you have in Oregon versus where is your market, I guess?
The market is in the western United States. Oregon, has three, perhaps four at this time.
And are
Arizona,
they,
Arkansas are popular places. Texas, popular place.
And are they pretty much in your area, the ones that are there now, or are they scattered in the state?
They're scattered. A couple of them here in the Portland area, and the other two I can't exactly remember where they're at right now.
Representing Buckley's parking lot.
I can't
And how do other states, in your recollection, how do other states deal with this vehicle?
Madam Chairman, it's been a mixed bag for us. We made the car as a track car. It has the track day lineage from Europe. Our customers know that. Different states have handled it differently. There's one state that issues a title to the vehicle pretty much as soon as the customer says that he has bought one. They don't even have to see the vehicle. Another state wants to see the vehicle, and they take a look at it and say, yes, it's got all of those safety features, horn, turn signals, and lights and that, and they issue a title at that time. And then other states have been a little bit harder on our customers in regard to that. But once again, we do not represent it to them as anything but a track day vehicle, and tell them that they may have to trailer it to the track, and they should be prepared for that.
So, follow up, and you know, and
I'm
not used to asking too many questions.
No, you're doing great. I'm going to guess our DMV folks are probably going to want to get behind the wheel and test it a little bit too.
So, in these other states that issue the title on these, when you're issued a title that. And maybe you can tell me in our state, too. Does that automatically mean that that's street-worthy?
It means it can be registered. And,
okay.
And then I'll defer to the DMV for the definition of street-worthy.
Chair Beyer, a title is a statement of ownership. In order to drive it on the streets, it has to be registered. And it has to be registered as some type of vehicle, and hence this legislation would create a very specific, very narrowly defined vehicle definition that this vehicle would fit. But in order to get that on the streets, it has to be registered.
Okay, and then another follow-up then. In Arizona, I think you talked about, is this a vehicle that can be driven on the street, or and are there any limits if it can?
Yes, Madam Chair, it can. They register it in that state.
And did they set any limits?
They do not set any limits.
Okay.
The other states, if I can expand
right.
upon that.
That would
the
be
other
great.
States are struggling with this as we are here. And so they're coming up with various solutions.
Thank you.
But Madam Chair, excuse me, you did bring up an excellent point, and that is that the registration of the vehicle, how transferable is that if it's purchased here in Oregon and used in Oregon? That may be one thing, but... You know, I've got questions about how it does transfer from if the people should move from Oregon to Arizona or to Arkansas or somewhere where there's lots of race activity. That you've raised a good question, and I'm not sure how that. Maybe some of these are going to Europe at that point.
Representative Buckley, do you want an answer, or is there an answer?
We are just now beginning to learn about those kind of activities. We have had one car be sold from its original owner to another owner. A California car sold to a New York owner. That New York owner is plowing new ground in terms of his DMV, and will they allow him to register it as we speak? So we don't know what the outcome of that will be. If it were sold to a customer in one of the states that already registers, then it would not be a problem at all.
Thank
California
you.
California is a community property state. His wife found out about it.
Representative Gilman.
Joe, I just want to say thank you for bringing this opportunity to us. We really like new industry, and especially in Southern Oregon, and this looks like a good addition to the manufacturing in our part of the state.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so...
Chair, we're waiting for some Dash 2 amendments,
yes.
as I understand it,
mm-hmm.
And then we can work with Representative Buckley on that.
I'm sure Carolyn would like to know whether or not, Representative Tomei would like to know whether or not they require helmets in these.
I can answer that. Certainly they're not required. You would have to make them required. We do strongly recommend them, okay? And all of our literature supports that.
Thank you, and my apologies for putting words in your mouth, Representative.
Madam Chair, quite honestly, they've got an excellent roll bar. It appears they've got a great roll bar in that process built into the system. So while the testimony is that thus far there's not been one of them turned over, the helmet really wouldn't be for the kinds of things that we typically associate the helmet for, the use of the helmet.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3527, and I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2982.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2982 decreases registration fees for motorhomes. I'm not sure if you want me to describe the Dash 2 amendments now or after.
Well, why don't we go ahead and wait on
okay.
that one.
Okay. We do have a no revenue impact still waiting for the fiscal, and this measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Okay. We have John and Donna Phillips.
Yeah, well, that's all right. And then I've got to get back as well. Are we ready to go here?
Sure, we're ready to go.
Good timing. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Clem, State Representative for Central and East Salem. And I just want to give you a little bit of a preface before you hear from my constituent. John and I talked about this bill. He showed me, maybe you've seen it now too in your packet, some pictures of the results of a somewhat ambiguous situation where some folks with the exact same vehicle will register one way as an RV and pay a higher fee, and other people with the exact same vehicle will register another way, and just, I guess, a vehicle is the term, and pay a much smaller fee. So this bill was our effort to try and clarify consistency, and I sort of agreed that philosophically, I don't know that I consider these little VW what do we call these big vans, I guess, the same as, you know, what we traditionally would think of as a big RV. So we try and get at some of that in the bill. Now, since that time, I've come to understand that we may need this bill for other purposes as well, and John and I have talked about that, and we're fine with that outcome. So I just want to come let you know we're not going to be offended by that, but we also wanted to have a discussion of the merits of the concept as well before you make decisions about that part. And with that, I'll leave you to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then these are amendments. I don't know if do you all have the amendments in the new fiscals? I have a bunch of copies. The dash two.
Dash one.
This reduces the price tag considerably.
Dash two.
Does anyone have any questions before Brian escapes out of here? Thank you.
Members of the committee, John Phillips, and I represent myself. I'm on vacation leave right now, and I don't represent my employer or anybody else. And it's my wife, Donna. And we have a van, actually, and we have a number of friends that have vans also that qualify under this statute. And I just want to take up a very short bit of your time this afternoon, just four quick points. They're bulleted at the bottom of the handout. And the first point is equity. The six vehicles in this picture pay $54 every 2 years except for one. And even though the one on the middle and the left, or excuse me, the middle and the right, looks virtually identical, if not identical to several others in the picture, that van pays $156 every 2 years. It's not about weight. It's not about size. It's not about fuel efficiency. It's just about a little clause in the statute that says this van in the middle on the right is a motorhome because it can sustain human life, I guess. Mm-hmm. We think it sustains human life, but actually it has a sink and a stove, and you can roll out a sleeping bag in it. So therefore it's a motorhome, and therefore it pays almost three times as much in registration fees. The second point is an accurate label. I think the only thing I can conclude is that a motorhome pays a higher fee because it goes to state parks or county parks, I guess. And what I think the point we're trying to make is that motorhomes in many cases are single-use vehicles. They're used for camping. This particular vehicle, because of its size and replication and other kinds of uses, is a multi-purpose vehicle. Our neighbors across the street drive to the Beanery every day for a coffee downtown here. That's what they use their motorhome for. They don't go to the park every day. We go to Home Depot or Lowe's to get supplies. We might run to Portland to pick up something. It's a multi-use vehicle, and so I think to call it a motorhome is a little bit misleading. The third point is the application of law is random and confusing. I've taken photos of a number of vans throughout the state, Hermiston, Portland, Salem. Twice as many are registered incorrectly as are registered correctly in my unofficial and informal survey. All you have to do is take a look at the vehicle, and if you know them, you can see which ones are quote-unquote motorhomes and which ones are not. I'm not saying these people are trying to register incorrectly and escape the larger fee, but it just may be confusing. They may wonder why they're a motorhome. I've talked to a lot of people, and they say, we don't need the law because our vehicle is registered as a passenger vehicle. But I think maybe they're confused or just uninformed. The fourth point is the connection between the fee and the benefit. One would think that if you pay a fee, then you're going to get a benefit in like whatever else, a parking fee, you get the benefit of parking space. There's nothing in the law that says that you, as a motorhome, have to go to a park, and that's the only thing you can do. So you go to the park, and guess what? You pay a fee to get in the park. So does the Humvee, so does the F-350 pickup, so does the Prius. They all pay a fee. But in addition to the fee, you get to pay $156 every 2 years, even if you don't go to the park. So what I'm saying is that the fee itself in the registration is not necessarily, in my mind, linked in any way to the benefit that you would get. So it's more like a tax. And I did check the tax laws, and it's not deductible on income taxes. So it's kind of a double whammy. Anyway, those are just some of the points. It was difficult. The bill came out different than what we asked for. And all we were trying to do was focus in on vehicles that looked and acted similar to passenger vehicles. And I think the Dash 1 amendments got that. And so I'm told that brings the revenue impact down. I've talked to parks, and I've talked to transportation, and it's even before session started. So I hope this is something you'll find exciting and interesting, and maybe if you have to couple it with a train concept, that would be fine with us.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, thank you for coming, and thank you for bringing your delightful wife, Donna. And that was the question I had, was we do have a Dash 2 amendment, which addresses some issues relative to the trains. In your opinion, can this bill be used for both, with the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, if they can be hashed together?
Chair Beyer and Representative Butler, we'd be happy to carry the weight of the, you know, if this concept will help that other idea, that's great. We would support that.
To follow up, if I may. John, I'm assuming because you do enjoy the outdoors and know your way around some of the back parts of the state of Oregon, that you indicate you had friends that had some of these. It looks like the other five vehicles, with perhaps the exception of the pickup and maybe the Humvee, could easily be tricked out. My recollection is that these can be tricked out for the sink and the water and the camping bed capacity for a few hundreds of dollars. So consequently, a person could buy them buy any one of these vehicles without those other kinds of things and then send them in to be tricked out so that they could have these other kinds of things. And legitimately, they were paying $54. When they're renewed, they should be paying $156. You know whether the DMV has an automatic kicker to come back and say to the people, has anything changed in this vehicle since it was last registered?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I think that's absolutely possible. I did call DMV early on. I don't recall who I spoke with. I didn't want to write the name down, but I did say, what can I do about this fee? And I was told, well, you can re-register your vehicle as a passenger vehicle. And I said, yes, but I think the law calls my vehicle a motorhome. And they said, well, yes. And I said, well, but I'll be fined, and it's not what the law says. And they said, well, you can do it.
So, Madam Chair, if I understand the basic concept here, it's where these rigs are under or 14 foot or less, we're not going to get into the bedroom activities of trying to figure out if you could roll out a sleeping bag when you lay everything out, the seats, and still have capacity for a sink and water storage and those kinds of things. We just say, hey, it's under 14 feet, therefore it ought to have. We're not going to be involved in trying to figure out whether last year you may have tricked it out and put the other things in. Is that your understanding, Judith, of the what it is that we've got here in the Dash 1 amendment and the original bill?
I would actually like Jack Evans to answer that for us.
Sure.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. What was the question?
Question.
I didn't catch
that.
Yes.
Was that the original bill, the petition of the original request is that without trying to get inside each vehicle as it's re-registered, the bill basically would be that motorhomes would be 14 feet and larger up to 14 feet in length, and then those that were larger than 14 feet in length would take on the characteristics of a motorhome, whereas those that were 14 feet and less would be licensed with the $54 passenger license plate, irrespective of the fact that the seats could lay out and accommodate someone sleeping in them, or if they put a mini bar in so that they have sink capacity and water storage, including gray water on board.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I had not anticipated talking about this bill, so I'm not very fluent in it, but that is my understanding, what you say is the case.
Okay, then I'll ask Jack, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Jack, will this bill accommodate both the original intention, because it sounds like the original intention is still a very viable and a very valid question with the state, with regard to the state of Oregon, and I look and there might be some fiscal impact, a few tens of thousands of dollars, by having everybody really just be legal with regard to their rigs that are 14 foot and less, that could or could not be tricked out depending upon what they would like to do. Will this bill accommodate both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I've been told that that is not the case, that the Dash 2 require a complete gut and stuff.
Madam Chair, while it may require a complete gut and stuff with the Dash 2, I'm wondering, there's a problem that needs to be solved with regard to the current licensure. We've got an honest taxpayer that comes forward, and I'll vouch for him. I've worked with John. He's come to Ontario. He's been very straightforward. The question I have is, if we've got someone that brings forward a question that needs to be resolved, is there a possibility that we can assist in the resolution of it? Is this the vehicle, or do we have another vehicle that's left open dealing with registration fees that we can utilize to gut and stuff the correct information in with regard to these 14-foot and less passenger vehicles, which can be tricked out?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, first of all, the Dash 1s and Dash 2s, including the original bill, deal with different sections of statute. So, in other words, the Dash 2s and Dash 1s do not conflict per se. I will say that I would want to consult with legislative counsel to see if you tried to amend both into the same bill, whether or not that would be considered multiple topics, Christmas tree type of bill. I will consult with them about that, and I would also check to see if there are any other unused bills with a correct relating to clause. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, if I miss this, my apologies, but what's the length of your Volkswagen van?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, it's 14 feet.
That's exactly 14 feet.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
The fees, if I might, are $126 for 6 to 10 feet, and then it's incremented at $7.50 per foot after that in the current law. And our intention was not to make trouble or bureaucratic, more government or trouble for any, you know, fiscal or revenue impact. And that's why I talked with Jack prior to session and with the parks, James Myron also.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and call up Kelly Taylor. Good Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Oregon Department of Transportation, Rail Division, and I was here to speak on the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The Dash 2 amendments are a replacement of the entire contents of the bill as it exists today, replacing it with language that is about passenger rail funding. It is about it is addressing a long-time problem. Currently, the two passenger trains that the state pays for between Eugene and Portland are paid for with general funds. Nearly every session, that funding is in jeopardy because, as you know, general funds are scarce and used for many, many things, schools, seniors disabled, law enforcement, et cetera. And when we were working through it last session, Ways and Means discussion, Representative Smith at the time was our chair of the subcommittee. Representative Butler knows this well because he's been the chair of our subcommittee. Again, it came up with, is there enough money to go around to pay for the two trains to keep them going? And they asked us to come back this session with an idea of how to start moving those trains off a general fund and get them onto a dedicated fund for themselves. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments do. They take the money that is paid for someone with a custom license plate, a vanity plate, like if I have my name, Kelly, on a plate. I don't have to have that. We'll give you ABC 123 as part of your registration fee. I pay extra. I volunteer to have my name on a plate or some catchy little phrase that I would like. And it's that $50 every 2 years that this bill would say goes towards the trains. Now, today that money goes towards the Team Litter Program. We would continue the Team Litter Program, but that activity can actually be paid for by the Highway Fund because it's a maintenance activity of the highway. And, in fact, some of the litter program are dump trucks and picking up the trash and everything after the kids have collected it are paid by highway funds. It's actually the teens' salary part that's coming out. We would continue to do that program. We think it's an important program, but we would pay for it out of highway funds. The department has a lot of different modes that they're responsible for, very little flexible funding, and that's why we brought this forth, saying, okay, this particular license plate fee is flexible. We'd like to offer a suggestion to pay for the trains. It will actually generate about $4.3 million a biennial, which is just about enough to pay for one of the trains, not quite. And I'd love to say it's a completely original idea and all that, and aren't we clever, but actually it was the legislature who came up with this idea two sessions ago. They did do a transfer in the 03 session with the money that was in the fund at the time and helped pay for one of the trains. And so we actually looked back and said, ah, this is actually in policy that's been done before. And so we've brought this forth to you in this form of a Dash 2 amendments. That would be a replacement of the current bill. And I would ask you to support the Dash 2s. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
The same question to Kelly. Is this bill incompatible after we add Dash 2 to accomplish the what it was that John and Donna Phillips were trying to accomplish, or is that too many issues? They all relate to vehicle registrations at that particular point, relating to registration fees.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I think the committee administrator has sort of hit it on the nose. I think that I do think we need to ask Ledge Council because it isn't, I don't think, so much that they conflict, but since the Dash 2 is a what's known as a gut and stuff, it's a complete removal and insertion, that the amendments in Dash 1 probably don't mend with it right now. Now, as to whether or not it's too many things going on in the bill, that I don't know. But I think the only reason why, for sure on paper, they wouldn't blend is because one is completely replacing and one's probably amending what's there and the other one's already removed it all. So if the committee wanted to do something like that, you would probably need to, A, check with Ledge Council, see if it's too many things in a bill, and, B, get yourself some language that does both things, if it can be done.
Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Is this the only bill that's outstanding that's relating to registration fees, vehicle registration?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, I do not know.
Okay. Seeing no other questions. Is there anyone else out there that needed to speak on this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Trucking Associations. And while I have not seen the Dash 2 amendments, based on Kelly's description of them, they're essentially identical to Senate Bill 225 that's sitting over in Senate Business and Transportation at the moment. My association is opposed to this concept, and essentially the issue from our perspective is we're backfilling with highway funds. We have no opposition whatsoever to the train, but we think that the subsidy for the train should be borne by all Oregonians. It shouldn't be placed on the back of highway users. Secondly, you know, we talk about all of the needs for our highways, and we've had several presentations so far this session where we've talked about those needs. But on the other hand, we're taking money and moving it over to subsidize the train. Again, I have no objection to the train, but I do believe that a subsidy should be paid for with general funds or some other funds and should not be borne by highway users. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Russell, that isn't what I expected you to say. I guess I'm somewhat confused. I would think that truckers would be delighted to have cars off the road not driving between Portland and Eugene so there'd be more room for truckers.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, if in fact the train was having a significant impact on highway congestion, then I would agree with you. But on the other, but my observation is that it does not. And what we're really talking about is taking highway funds and using them for that purpose. When we talk about other trains, for example, light rail that we have in Portland, certainly it's funded and we support the funding because, in fact, that does reduce highway congestion. But it's not funded with highway funds.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Gilman.
Bob, because we're backfilling with highway funds, I can understand why you're saying that we're using highway funds. But the truth of the matter is we're using vanity plate funds, which are not, in my estimation, highway funds. They just happen to be used for litter at this particular time.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, I'm not disputing the legality of what we're talking about, but today those funds are used for a highway-related purpose, and we are tomorrow going to take funds that could be used to fill potholes, to build projects, and we're going to backfill. That's my issue.
Madam Chair, just one question. Bob, you'd mentioned that this Dash 2 gut and stuff is identical to something else that exists somewhere else in the building?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I didn't say identical because I haven't seen the Dash 2.
So. Okay.
But based on Kelly's description, it's the same as Senate Bill 225 that is on the other side.
If I could follow up, is Senate Bill 225 moving at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, it has not received a hearing as of this date.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, that may answer the question I previously asked with regard to the with Representative Clem's original bill. If there was some way to accomplish for his constituents the desire of some of a very apparent ambiguity and still have a Senate Bill 225 in play to accomplish substantially what the Dash 2 amendments are doing, then maybe that's something that the committee would want to consider. So,
thank you, Representative Butler, and thank you, Bob. I'm going to go ahead, if I don't see any more questions, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2982, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2982.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to 2982.
Thank you. Representative Gilman has moved the dash two amendments dated, which I just put away.
319 of 07
to House Bill 2982. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to echo Representative Butler's concern. I do hope we can find a vehicle for the original proposal, because I do think that is an issue of fairness that does need to be addressed.
Thank you, and I agree with you, and I will work on that one and make sure that we do have a vehicle for that one way or another. So I appreciate your concern. All right, any other discussion? Seeing none, any objections? No. Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move 2982 to the floor of the due pass recommendation as amended.
To the Ways and Means.
Oh, it's got to go to Ways and Means.
To the floor and.
Yeah, okay. Now, with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Gilman has moved House Bill 2982 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye.
And for the record, Representative Reed is excused. And Representative Smith. And the motion carries.
Madam Chair, my yes is a yes, understanding that you will do your best to accommodate Representative Clem. I think that he was gracious enough to offer this bill, recognizing that there was someone that had a greater good to do with it. I still feel that his constituents and the issue really needs to be addressed.
And thank you, Representative Butler. I did too when I met with them, and so we'll work on that.
Thank you very much.
All right. I closed the work session on House Bill 2982, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3273.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3273 allows the waymaster or motor carrier enforcement officer to use warning lights or other signals for purposes of stopping a driver of a commercial motor vehicle. We have received a no revenue impact and still waiting for the fiscal on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. We have a list of people that want to testify on this, and we have one person who says he's from more than 100 miles, so I'm going to go ahead and call him. Michael Cobb, and then Kermit Mailing, you can come up at the same time. You can pick whoever you want to. You probably want to go first.
I probably get to go first. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Commission. My name is Kermit Mailing. I'm here from SEIU Local 730, the ODOT local, and I'm also a senior motor carrier enforcement officer for the state of Oregon, employed out of Portland. What we're asking in House Bill 3273 is to give the motor carrier enforcement officers to give our authority clarification that would allow us to do a practice that we legitimize, a practice that we've done for almost 30 years. 30 years ago, back in 1977, motor carrier enforcement officers, then called waymasters, were using Ford Pinos, green ones to be exact, like they are for the Forest Service, and using stop paddles and amber lights to stop trucks to do inspections and to weigh them. We've evolved over the years to where we're now using very nice, well-lighted vehicles, and there has been a progression. And inside this book that each one of you have, I've laid out a timeline of different DOJ's opinions, starting with the one in 1988, where they asked for the designation of emergency vehicles, which we don't need because under our statute of authority, it allows us to chase bypassers of the scales. And our authority is pretty well spelled out throughout our 810-530 and 810-410. And it gives us, you know, specific things that we're allowed to do. And as long as we work within those confines, we're doing. What we're asking for is a clarification to allow us to use our lights to stop overweight vehicles and vehicles with unsafe conditions roadside versus just in the scales. Many of our back roads, we don't have scale facilities on in the remote areas. And in order to build some of these things, a 300-foot by 27-foot wide pullout would cost approximately $25,000. And that's not counting the land. That's just asphalt excavation and putting, you know, sub-base down and asphalting it. So in order to catch up to where we'd have to be in order to do the practice without having the ability to do our lights, it would take us years, you know, through highway project improvements where they could build these projects for us. And in the meantime, our roads will be deteriorating. The roads are vital not only to the citizens of the state of Oregon, but also to the truckers in the state of Oregon. I was in the industry for 20 years. I started breaking down tires when I was 20, and I was an owner-operator as well. So I've been on both sides of the fence. I got my first citation at Wyeth Scale on I-84 hauling hay cubes back from Circle C Farms. I swear their scale was legal up there. But so I've both given and received on both things, and I have a lot of compassion for the guys that are working out on the road for a living driving. And so what we're asking for is we're not asking to be armed. We don't need to be. We're not asking to be placed in police and firemen's fund because we're not police officers and we're not firemen. We're enforcement officers, and that's all we are. And as long as we keep it in the proper context and do our job according to the limitations that are placed on us, the only thing we have to worry about is our own ego. And through training and learning how to deal with our clients as we should, that should not be a problem. Any questions?
Any questions? Why don't you go ahead and if anyone has any questions, we'll...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Michael Cobb. I'm currently employed as a waymaster, a motor carrier enforcement officer for the state of Oregon, working in the Ashland District. Prior to that, I've been so employed for about the last 3.5 years. Prior to that, I spent 23 years as a police officer in Southern California. I'm here today to address the safety issues of the Waymaster and my point of view, having been a Waymaster that was able to pull over trucks here and a police officer who dealt with felons and average people who ran stop signs and stoplights and that sort of thing. It's my opinion that the Waymaster motor carrier enforcement officer deals with the same limited part of the public, either at a scale or roadside, it doesn't matter. We're not going to be stopping felons who just robbed a bank. We're not going to be pursuing vehicles down the highway, lights and siren, because we don't have sirens and we don't want them. We're going to be dealing with the trucking industry. The only time we're going to really stop the trucking industry is if we see a violation or what we believe to be a violation. Perfect example of that was one of the last trucks I stopped prior to the policy change was a truck that was a dump truck leaving a construction site in Grants Pass, driving down Highway 238, and then he makes a turn like he's going to go up this steep residential road. When that truck made that turn, the body lean on that truck and the compression on the tires was such that I felt it was overloaded. Stopped that truck, took him back down to the bottom of the hill where we weighed him, and he was 10,000 pounds over on a tandem axle. Had that truck went up that hill and lost the engine or not been able to apply its brakes properly, who knows what would have happened. So our point of view is that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. We're trying to go back to do what we were doing prior to this policy change. Simply keep the motoring public and the public in general safe and have the trucking industry operate in a safe manner, which I think 99.9% of them want to do anyway. And there's been issues of, are we safe in doing this roadside? Can we do this safely? Well, we've been doing it. They were doing it safely long before I appeared here. I don't believe that there's ever been a injury or anything related to pulling a truck over on the highway or an assault or anything else. Having sat on both sides of the fence and having dealt with the trucking industry both in a scale house and a roadside, I've never felt threatened by any of them. Yeah, they get a little upset occasionally because they're mad at the system. Okay, the system is not right. And so you know, as a motor carrier enforcement officer, they're not mad at you, they're mad at the system. And so you talk to them a little bit, talk them down. We're all trained to do that in a scale house. It'd be the same thing out on the highway. We just deal with the situation, end it as quickly as we can. They'll move on, we'll move on, and everybody will be safer as a result. Any questions?
I'd like to add, he's correct. In the 30 years that motor carrier enforcement officers have been doing roadside stops, nobody has ever been assaulted or hurt. And I've worked Highway 101 down by Rockaway weighing asphalt trucks in the middle of the night, and the only people that ever came up to me was the town drunk and a raccoon. So, I mean, you know, the drivers, they know us. We work with these guys. Each officer has their district. Mine's the five northern counties in the state of Oregon. And you learn, you build up a relationship with the guys that drive routinely in your area. Most of the ones we stop are the people that we see day in and day out when we're working those areas because they're our neighbors. So it's not as bad as it sounds.
Thank you. Representative Butler, then Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask these two gentlemen what training is needed for the Waymaster for motor carrier enforcement officers. What is the training presently required? And will SEIU or others come back at a later date and demand a higher level of training?
If you take a look at tab 8 in there, in the notebooks, there's a training that says all in part basically what would training might look like for a motor carrier enforcement officer. And you see in there resolving conflict, verbal judo, which is just another form of resolving contact. Back in 1996, Region 1 ODOT maintenance put all the employees up there through a wintertime skid car class, which was great. I think every teenager should have to take this before they get their driver's license. Stopping vehicle procedures, pursuit driving, not high-speed pursuit, but pursuit driving. That was a three-day course that we took at DBST, the Police Standard and Training at Corvallis. And basically what they showed us was how to change lanes at 55 miles an hour, how to use your brakes and your accelerator to keep you from losing control of the vehicle. So if you go into a turn, don't put on the brakes in the turn. Put the brakes on before you get to a turn so that you're not changing the weight up to the front end corner of the car, bringing the rear end around, using it as a pivot point. So those are the type of skills that they taught us, as long as handling hostile customers, public contact skills. A lot of it just is plain customer service. Treat people respectfully, and they're going to treat you respectfully.
So the question I had, Madam Chair, was will any additional training in addition to these basic training concepts be needed in the future, or are these sufficient? And I really appreciate their personal testimony. Are these sufficient for your members and staff and other motor carrier enforcement officers to get the job done under this bill?
I believe it is. I believe that the training that I received when I came here was more than adequate to accomplish the mission that we're out to accomplish. I mean, our primary focus is size and weight enforcement and data collection. We do the majority of that at a fixed scale site. The stopping of vehicles on the highway or wherever is a very minor part of our total duties. I mean, it's just an incidental part of our duties. Unlike OSP officer who his primary function is to stop speeders on the highway. That's not our primary function. Our primary function is really data collection and size and weight enforcement while we're doing that.
Follow up then. Hello. So there have been no incidents of high-speed stops by the motor carrier enforcement officers?
By policy, I believe that our speed at the time when we were allowed to do this was no more than 10 miles an hour over the posted speed limit and only on the major highways. In other words, you can't drive 10 miles an hour down a residential street.
And a final question in this regard, if I may, Madam Chair. Why did the department change the policy? Why was it changed, do you think?
That was a DOJ opinion.
It was, yes. And tab 2, let me get back to the front of this. Tab 6 has the DOJ's opinion. That was asked, do motor carrier enforcement officers have the authority to use their lights to stop? And in the opinion right there, it says that we should seek legislative changes in order to clarify our authority. And that's what we're asking for. We're asking for you to clarify, to tell us what we can and what we cannot do. Our authority is pretty much spelled out in 810 or 510, or I get 810 mixed up, excuse me. But it's pretty well spelled out what we can do in under limited circumstances. That's when we have the same authority as a police officer to make a stop and do certain things, issue citations, things like that. That's pretty much it. What we're asking for is the ability to use the lights to patrol the back roads and to keep those ones off. Most of the trucks that go through the scales and are fairly legal. I mean, those are the over-the-road trucks. They go all the time. Back in the early 2000, we were working a lot with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. They had four truck enforcement officers that solely did truck inspections. We would take these guys, and we would travel all over the state of Oregon with them. We'd go over and work in Wasco County. They travel with me quite a bit. We'd go down and work on the coast. Rainier was one of our favorite spots. We'd catch the guys coming over the bridge. We usually had an 80% out-of-service rate to 100% out-of-service rate when we first started going up there. By the time they disbanded their unit, I think it was like last two legislative sessions ago when they did away with the MXAP funds to outside agencies and gave it to OSP, Multnomah County disbanded their four officers. They were doing 2,700 truck inspections a year, which is quite a large number. They were very very good at it. They were some of the best people I've ever worked with. And we were down to close to a 50% out-of-service rate in Rainier by the time they disbanded the unit. If you go out in these outer areas, you start catching the trucks that are truly have the violations and that. And that's one thing that is going to happen is that for a while the curve is going to be real steep. There's going to be a lot of out-of-service trucks. This is something we worry about because we know that once we do start going back to enforcement and only officers that are trained in how to drive the vehicles and stuff will be allowed to do so, is that it has to be a gradual thing to let industry know that we're back out there and to help bring them into compliance. We don't want to go out there with a hammer and beat on their heads. These guys are out there making a dollar. Things are tough. Price of fuel's high. What's the one thing that they usually cut back on? And it's maintenance.
Excuse me, I beg your pardon, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may.
Sure.
Thank you. I think you're making this harder than it needs to be. As I'm looking at this,
yes,
we have
ma'am.
A great big law. We have several pages of law. All you were asking
is to use the lights.
Again.
Yes. Is that...
Yes, ma'am.
That was going to be my question. I was going to say, you know, look at this. Look at all
information. I know. So I just...
Well, they do. Just use the lights.
I just want to make sure I understand that. So you're asking that we add, in after 45 and 31, that 76 lines. And then the next line is on page 3, line 1. In order to enforce commercial motor vehicle requirements, a waymaster, may stop and detain vehicles, right? And then the next line is exercising the same authority as a police officer. using warning lights or other signal, right? And then down on line 19, warning lights or other signal. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that is
That's
exactly.
Just full
what, I wanted to do with this notebook is to give you all the information, both pro and con, that's came out since 1988, so that when it comes time for somebody to make a decision on what's going on, that you had all the information. Nothing hidden, nothing held back that's good or bad, against us or for us. It's in this book.
Again, I guess that goes back to not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're just trying to go back to doing what we were doing 2 years ago.
You want to finish up here?
The opinion was issued in May of 2004. Why didn't we see this in 2005 in the regular legislative session?
It was here.
Oh, okay. And final question, and this is probably to Kermit. One of the two of you is from Southern Oregon?
I am, sir.
Okay. I have a high respect that worked with a person from your department down there in another division, and then he transferred over to the motor carrier division. I think he's a supervisor down there. Sven Johnson?
Yes.
What would he say if I asked Sven, pick up, because he's my go-to kind of guy on this kind of stuff, what would Sven say if I said, Sven, should we be voting this through at lightning speed at the legislature? What would he tell me?
Are you asking me what I would think Sven would say?
Yes, sir.
I think he would support us going back to doing our full job.
Good enough for me. Thank you. I'm sure this is set up for a work session today, too, I think, too, isn't it?
Just a public hearing today. And we have a few more people that do want to testify. Okay. Maybe you'll get a little better idea.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming,
you,
and thank you for all the work that you've done. And Bob Russell and Dee Bridges.
I love the front picture, however. Looks like something I'd be doing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we're here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3273. There's really two reasons why we oppose it. There's one far more important than the other. The most important is safety to us. When we look at the kinds of violations that we're talking about, a truck that's overweight, and that's not a safety issue per se in most instances. Now, certainly if it's grossly overweight, it could be, but for the most part, it is not. However, chasing vehicles with flashing lights on congested highways can be a safety issue, and we're very concerned about that. There are a number of other tools that DOT has in their toolbox to deal with those kinds of situations. They can do administrative complaints. They can send tickets in the mail. They can file all kinds of things if someone bypasses a scale or does that kind of stuff. In those instances, when there's an egregious problem, they can call OSP, and OSP, to my knowledge, has been very responsive and has chased down whatever they need to chase down. So the second reason that we have an issue with this is because of the cost. Chair Beyer noted that this bill, or one very close to it, was here last session. At that time, the Department of Transportation prepared a fiscal impact statement and indicated that it would cost, in the first biennium, about $1.3 million for training, equipment, and those kinds of things. And, of course, there would be ongoing costs as well.
And the trucking industry pays the full cost of the size and weight program, as we do with all motor carrier programs. And we think that this money could better be spent on roads when we see a real safety issue in allowing this to go forward. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Russell, do you know if any accidents or unsafe situations had happened when they were able to do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I do not personally have any knowledge of accidents or those kinds of things when they were able to do this.
Thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Russell, your testimony refers to a high-speed chase. Why would a truck driver engage in a high-speed chase if they're being flagged down by a car with a flashing light?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, the last time I encountered this situation, the Waymasters were on I-5, and, you know, the bypass lane, the truck bypass lane up by the Terwilliger curves, and we're sitting on the other side of that in rush hour traffic, and trucks that were not able to get over into the truck bypass lane because of the volumes of traffic, they were stopping them right there in rush hour traffic. Yes, they weren't high-speed chases in that instance, but it was a highly dangerous situation. There are other instances where trucks would bypass the scale inadvertently or for whatever reason, and they would be going highway speeds. In order to catch up to the truck, they would have to go faster than the highway speed, so there could conceivably be a high-speed chase.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, this certainly sheds new light, my concern is this fiscal impact. We're told that no additional training is necessary, no additional staff, and we've got pictures of the vehicles that are in existence. Why would there be a $1.3 million fiscal on this, do you think?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, you know, if you look at the bill, at least the way I read it, on page 3, it says, in order to enforce commercial vehicle requirements, a waymaster or motor carrier enforcement officer may stop and detain vehicles, exercising the same authority as a police officer. The fiscal that I was given from last session indicated that there would be training required from DPSST. There would be other equipment that would also be required. You know, one of the things that we're used to when we're motorists out there are the police with the blue lights, sirens, and all those kinds of things. This is would be a very different thing the way it's being described. However, I believe that the Department of Transportation anticipated that if this legislation were to go forward, then they would have to treat these folks more like police officers and provide them with the training and the equipment necessary to safely perform the duties that this bill would require.
Can
I, Representative Butler, if I could follow up, just to follow up on the statute that's listed in the bill, ORS 810-490, simply it describes any police officer may stop, measure, and weigh any vehicle or combination of vehicles. So it means there's really nothing in the statute has to do with any kind of crime-fighting training, or it's simply the same, as I read, the same procedure that would be done at a weigh station, for instance, of checking for the weight in the vehicle. There's really nothing outside of the procedures of the job of a waymaster. So I'd be glad to pass the book to the other members of the committee if they'd like to see it.
And just to follow up, then, if I
yes,
may.
Yes, follow up.
Still
you.
Looking at the same kinds of issues that are in 810-490, what do you anticipate the meaning of the next sentence, using warning lights or other signal, may mean, Bob?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I would assume that other signal is referring to a siren.
Thank you.
Mr. Bridges, do you want to add anything?
I'm sure, members of the committee. D.E. Bridges for Oregon Log Truck Association. I'm here today representing them and also the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee, commonly known as MCTAC, has been meeting for about 10 years. We meet almost every month. We discuss issues relating to the trucking industry. The committee exists consists of about 50% public members, private members, I guess I should say, people like Bob and myself who are members, other trucking interests, AAA, the Farm Bureau, and the other half are public members, members of ODOT motor carriers, sometimes the bridge folks or the highway folks come in. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is represented there. Oregon State Police is represented there. We had a meeting on March 15, our regular meeting, and we discussed, among other things, House Bill 3273. And as a result of that, the discussion, which is what you have before you there, or not the discussion, but we voted to have a resolution to oppose this bill, and that resolution is what you have in front of you there. And I just wanted to highlight some of our concerns there. I guess, first of all, ODOT, for whatever reason, I think, and I just hear this anecdotally, is going to take a neutral position on this bill. I think OSP is going to take a neutral position on this bill. At least that's what they told us at the MCTAC meeting. However, in 2005, when this bill was before the legislature, ODOT did oppose the bill, and in fact, it did not even receive a hearing, which, frankly, we felt is the disposition that it deserved. Secondly, the legislature should at all times be conscious of the safety of public employees, professional drivers, and the public. A representative of the Oregon State Police informed us at that meeting that more police officers are killed nationally by vehicles than are killed by felonious assault. He was pretty emphatic that it's kind of dangerous stuff out there standing alongside the highway making a stop. And in fact, in the latest issue of the Motor Carrier News, it talks about, let me just quote this, OSP troopers commonly refer to the safe distance law as Maria's Law, in honor of Maria Mignano, a senior trooper who died in September 2001, along with an Albany police officer when a driver struck them on the roadside at Interstate 5, just north of Albany. This is serious stuff. And I think one thing that just kind of came to my mind as we were talking back here, Bob talked about training, and other folks have talked about training, and that's where that fiscal came from. I think there's also a matter of experience. When you a police officer, an OSP officer makes, you know, hundreds of stops a year. I'm going to jump ahead here. We asked Forth what exactly is broken that HB 3273 seeks to repair. And we were told by the manager of that division, the size and weight officer supervisor, that only a tiny fraction, and he said less than 1/500th of 1% of trucks actually blow by a scale. The resolution refers to 1/10. Less than 1/10 of 1%, so you can use your own judgment about which of those is more accurate. But the point is that it's only a tiny, tiny percentage of people who would really need to be stopped. And what the practice is now, as we were told, is that they just simply call OSP or other law enforcement down the road, give them the license number, the name of the truck or whatever, and they make the stop down there. And I said, well, okay, well, what happens if you don't get a license number? I mean, if you don't know who that is, or on the other side, inside lane or something. He says, we just get in our car and we drive down there, we get a license number, and then we turn around and come back. So that's the way the situation works right now. I think it's very safe. at least a heck of a lot safer than running somebody down and putting them off the road. So as I said, I skipped ahead just a little bit. So let me just it was pretty emphatic that there would need to be a lot of extra training. OSB particularly felt that at that meeting and told us that there should be a lot of extra training that they do not now have, and I think that's where that fiscal impact comes up. Bob talked about the blue lights, and I guess I don't need to talk any further about that, so I guess I'm done.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bridges, I think it's commendable that you're concerned about safety. So have you heard of any accidents or any bad events that had happened when they were able to do this previously?
I have not, personally.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up.
And can you show me where in the bill it says that they will utilize red overhead lights?
Representative Tomei, Madam Chair, I have not. I don't know. I can't tell you. That's what they have on their vehicles right now.
Okay.
Follow up. Sorry.
And you suggested that it would be the state police that could come around. I travel I-5 quite a bit, very frequently, because I live in Milwaukee and travel here. And I imagine you travel a lot on I-5. How often do you see state police on I-5?
Representative Tomei, Madam Chair, I commute from Junction City.
Okay.
So I'm on I-5 quite a bit.
Okay.
And I see him quite frequently.
Do you? I don't. And I just find that curious that if they were to see someone who was violating this, and that they would call the state police and they would be able to respond in time to find them. And you also mentioned that it would just really be a very small percentage of people who would be violating this, and therefore that they would have to do something about. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
So actually this wouldn't be utilized very often, is that right?
The information that was given to us at the meeting was, because I asked that question specifically, how mm-hmm. big a problem is this? And the supervisor for these folks said less than 1/500 of 1% of trucks actually blow by a scale and would be subject to this.
So follow up. So it would be a very, very infrequently that they would have to use this process. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, just and it's a question now for DPSST. Do we have the ability to train these folks? I guess I didn't understand that there was going to be this much training and fiscal involved. It sounded like these folks were all ready to go. The trucks are all in place and they have been trained in the past through 2004. Do we know anything about DPSST?
We don't. We do have someone from ODOT coming up, but since it's not a work session, it's just a public hearing today, we can make sure that we get the kind of information we need.
And Madam Chair, the lights shown on the rigs that they've got, I thought all these rigs were in place, and it was just a matter of the fact that starting to use them again with people that were trained do, in fact, show red lights. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a quick response, Madam Chair. I don't think the bill designates the color of the lights, but I'd be interested in getting information on what training took place previously as well, and to see if there was a fiscal involved at that point. And if we saved a significant amount of money, what that money's been spent on in the meantime. I'd like to know.
Thank you.
Sounds like the
hopefully
training.
Someone's getting this.
The training was ongoing.
Thank you, gentlemen. And now we have Larry Campbell and Don Miner.
Don couldn't stay.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. It was interesting, Representative Tomei's question about how often you see a state police officer. We're certainly hopeful that the legislature will take steps to increase that. And when you recognize there are 106 waymasters and about three times the number of state police officers, you recognize the shortage that we have of state police officers. Representing our two associations today, I must say that we are expressing strong opposition to House Bill 3273. Traffic stops represent one of the most dangerous activities police officers conduct in the course of their work. And before you ask the question, Representative Torme, you'll probably remember the accident on I-5 where one of our police officers was killed and another is still in a coma as a result of being alongside the road, taking activity and action on an issue. For police officers, every traffic stop can potentially escalate into a violent encounter. They mentioned the number of times that the folks up in Rainier were stopping trucks for safety checks and so forth. One of the things I'd like to point out is we have similar checks made by the Oregon State Police, and they're basically looking for drugs. And by the way, they're finding them. And some of these people that bypass way stations, from our perspective, may be bypassing them for reasons other than just a failure to recognize they should stop. And basically, when you look at this, a routine traffic stop may end up with an arrest of criminal behavior that can run the gamut of crimes from misdemeanors to all others listed in Oregon law. Waymasters are not properly trained to conduct traffic stops, are only authorized to enforce a narrow set of motor carrier laws, and are employed by a regulatory agency, not a law enforcement agency. In Oregon, police officers receive 16 weeks of basic training, and I'd like to point out that it was found that we were not giving our police officers enough training because their former requirement was 10 weeks. And in essence, they're doing very much the same thing that these folks are suggesting they might do on our highways like I-5. In addition, before they're employed, police recruits must pass competency tests, background checks, physical fitness evaluation for the purpose of determining their fitness for duty, and to ensure the greatest possible safety for the public. When trouble occurs during a traffic stop, and the young man, and of course to me everybody's young these days, that spoke from down south indicating he was a former police officer, would recognize that the tools of the trade are available to those police officers, and those tools include weapons, tasers, handcuffs, defensive tactics that were gained by training, and to make an appropriate use of force choice based on their training. Police officers also have the ability to call for backup if it's demanded, and they also have something else that's extremely important. They have the ability to recognize or access critical criminal record information from dispatch in order to prepare for difficulty in advance of the stop. Currently, when a commercial motor vehicle fails to stop at a way station, waymasters contact law enforcement in order to make a traffic stop. This is the appropriate course for the reasons I've previously outlined. We, by the way, would support transferring the motor carrier enforcement responsibility to the Oregon State Police, where properly trained police officers under the direction of a law enforcement agency and vehicles equipped for pursuit are well suited to perform this function. Maybe I provided that with a little tongue-in-cheek, because waymasters perform a very important function and should continue to focus on their core responsibilities. Authorizing waymasters to conduct traffic stops for failure to stop at a way station would create liability and increased risk to the public and to motor carrier enforcement personnel. We urge you to oppose House Bill 3273. And in closing, I would merely say there are all kinds of accidents every day on I-5, the traffic area that you're traveling, Representative Tomei, the area that Dee Bridges travels from the south every day. And what we don't want to do is confuse things more on the highway and have more stops on the highway that we have to be concerned about. One of the real dangers from a law enforcement standpoint isn't just the stop. It's when that truck leaves the side of the road to go back on the highway. So from our perspective, They should be, if they're going to be given the responsibility of making stops using a vehicle with a light on it, they should be fully trained with the necessary training, and that comes from BPSST. And I would share with you that that is training that's available, Representative Butler. It's a question of whether or not we're willing to spend the money and keep people safe. Thank you very much for letting me share with you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I would ask you the same question that I asked the other gentleman. Do you know of any accidents when they indeed did do this, that any accidents or any bad events that happened when they did have the ability to do this over the
Representative years? Tomei, if you would, Madam Chair, if you would recognize that there's a danger on the highway every day, and whether they particularly had an accident in the past, we're having them every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having, as I mentioned, police officers killed in Oregon. Peace officers put in a coma in Oregon. And all we're saying is these were trained people. And we're talking about basically putting folks out with a light. And, you know, another interesting question would be, at night, if you were driving your car and a car that does not look like a police car but has a light were to stop you or try to stop you, what would your response be? We're deeply concerned about the aspects of this. We don't criticize the waymasters. What we're basically saying is we need to be very concerned when we put something like this on the highway that indeed it is going to be safe. And the only way you can even guarantee potential safety is with proper training. And when you talk about proper training, Representative Butler, we're right back to the cost associated with it. That's the reason that basically we've gone from 10 weeks of training for our police officers in this state to 16 weeks.
Thank you.
Oh.
It's obvious you feel very strongly about this, but I guess I'm going to get back again to, you know, of any bad events that did happen when they did do this for over how many years they did it.
I don't, and it's because I haven't done any checking on
okay.
the issue. It isn't because it didn't happen. It's just because I, on that particular question, have not looked into it.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Larry, there's 106 waymasters. Their job description is already outlined here. Basically, what they're asking for is a return to the ability to stop and detain vehicles, exercising some additional authority. Will their job description change from what it is today if we just leave the law alone? And will their time be better utilized? It sounds like they would like to have this additional responsibility. What's going to happen if they just continue to do what they're doing today? Will their time be as well utilized or better utilized than what it would be if they were given the authority to enforce the commercial vehicle by stopping and detaining vehicles?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, I'm not qualified to answer that question. I would say that we fully expect them to do their jobs at the weigh stations, and our big concern isn't what they do with their weigh station responsibility. It's what they do on our highways with a vehicle that is lighted.
Follow-up question, if I may.
Follow-up.
Finally, Larry, because you're representing the Chiefs of Police as well as the Sheriff's Association, what of the communications capacity of these lighted vehicles that they presently have? Do they have the same police channels that they can communicate with them and alert them from the vehicle if they see someone blow by and have to go and retrieve a license number and so forth?
I don't know, but I'll find out. My expectation would be that they are not equipped with communications in the same manner that our state police cars are.
So that would be, Madam Chair, if I may, it sounds like that's a potentially additional cost of communications in addition to the additional training and vehicular additions. I'm assuming that we'll get a fiscal on this at some particular point because we know what we're talking about.
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, I'll get back to you on an answer to that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Campbell, just out of curiosity, do you know what the policy is in the state of California or the state of Washington, our I-5 neighbors, in terms of waymasters?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I do not know what the waymasters' responsibilities are in those states. But I'll also find that out for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to call up Jack Evans, but Kermit, if you don't mind coming up again, I think you had a couple of responses to a couple of the questions down here. And Jack, if you want to, this doesn't mean you two are together.
We're not.
You want to go ahead, and I know you had a couple.
Yeah. We do have OSP radios. We've had them ever since I've been on duty. That is the only people that we can talk to is OSP. It's true that we can go after a truck that bypasses the scale and find and get the license number and then return back the thing. But it's still, the truck has already gone down the road, so you're still going to have to go basically the same pace that you would if you turned your lights on once you got behind him in order to catch up with the truck if you were going to either get the license plate number, which you'd have to get to the front of the truck to do so, or if you were going to be behind him with your lights going. And if you take a look at our light, the pictures of our cars of the vehicles, And I have a lot of respect for what they're saying, both of them, as far as what the vehicles. Our vehicles have traffic advisory sticks in the back, and when we're bringing a vehicle back onto the highway, the officers use those. We have four-corner strobes, we have flashing lights in the rear, and we have the overhead lights. So we use the traffic advisory to advise traffic that we are bringing a vehicle back out into the lane of traffic. And we tell the truck drivers, wait till you have a clear spot or we clear the traffic for you. And we will pull our vehicles off or pull our vehicles into the travel lane with the traffic advisory over, and then traffic shifts over if, say, if we're on I-205 or something like that. But we warn traffic that we're bringing the truck back out onto the highway. A lot of times when we stop trucks, we make sure we're not stopping them going uphill because the truck cannot get started going back uphill. You take a chance of them breaking their clutch or driveline or whatever. So we usually follow them to a very safe spot. On I-5, what Russell Bob was talking about is we were responding to complaints that our agency was getting concerning trucks not using the truck lane on I-5. So we were actually asked to go out there and enforce this. And it's something that they had done for previously in years. So, yes, we did go out there. We were doing it. But the officers were following the trucks to the downhill side over toward the Twilliger curves. There was a wide spot where the guys would activate their lights and get the truck over to the shoulder of the road in a spot that was safe and it was wide enough for us to do so. In that, then the question was brought about in one of the DOJ's opinions, is that something that we should be doing? And the answer came back, no, that is a police function, and we ceased doing that. But there was a clarification from the DOJ on that because there was not a size and weight restriction to it, only that the trucks needed to use that thing, and that was a traffic violation, and it was something that we shouldn't be dealing with because it's not in our authority. But we were originally asked to do so, so that's why we were out there. As far as the training goes, if you look back at the training tab or tab 8, where I listed out the verbal judo and stuff, the types of verbal training that we had, I also included three different training transcripts. One is mine. I've been on for 14 years. There's an officer's in here for 7 years and an officer that's been in for a year and a half. And the ones on mine on the page 2 and 3 show asterisks as to the training that we took, and basically it's the same stuff that was outlined in the front of it, the resolving conflict, the verbal judo, the how to stop vehicles, and the pursuit driving that we did take through BPST down at the Corvallis Airport through the school, and it was a 3-day course. Basically, I've heard the argument, yes, it's going to take 4 months, and yes, I've heard it, we could do it in 4 hours. Somewhere in between, about a 2-week course, you know, put together mostly by our department. I've got a deputy out of Columbia County that is an EVOC trainer that said that I asked him the question. I says, could you design a course for us that we could do? And he says, yeah, I could design a couple-day course for you guys, no problem. Do we have vehicles to do it? No, we could do them in our cars. We have Impalas. They're not pursuit equipped, so we cannot drive them over 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. That's in our policy. And it's in our policy that we will not violate the basic rules established by the ORS. We can't blow lights. We can't do any of that stuff. If that happens, you break off. On Highway 212, when a truck bypasses the scale there, you have one option. You can either go after it, which is really highly unlikely because traffic's too heavy on there. And if you did go after it, if he made it through the first light and you didn't, forget it, because you're never going to catch him before he gets to I-205 and you'd never know where he went. So do you pursue? No, you don't. You only do it in areas where you know the traffic and you know that you can get, you know, behind them safely and do it. And that's based on training that we have had in the past, is for the officers to be trained to make these decisions correctly. When we stop vehicles, most of the guys, they know their areas, they know them really well, so you know your wide spots. So you pick your spot where you're going to stop a truck if you want to stop them and address them for size and weight violations.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes.
I get so much information, I'm trying to put it in different boxes.
I'm sorry.
So help me understand. So you have the ability to do this now. You have the ability now. If a truck goes by the way station, you have the ability to go after it. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm hearing you say that.
Yes, ma'am.
Follow up? So all you're asking, you've got the ability to do that. You've got the training to do that. You've got the training, the ability to stop somebody and however you deal with them, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Follow up? So all you're asking for is to have a light so that the truck that you're following will know that you're following them. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, and to warn the traveling public that we are about to do something. After the 2004 DOJ's opinion, when we stopped, officers were actually having to pull up alongside of the truck and point, which is the other signal, not a siren, but point or a hand signal to get the guy to pull over. Then you had a choice. You either sped up and got in front of him and hoped that he decelerated to the shoulder of the road slower than you did, or you backed up traffic and got behind him. By using our lights, we're actually being safer because we're warning traffic that we're doing something and that we're and most all truckers know who we are.
Follow up. Thank you. So have you had any bad experiences? Have you had any accidents or had somebody pull a gun on you where you felt, not just you, but other people in your business, that you felt unsafe?
No, only once on Highway 730. I was working Cold Spring Junction late at night, and a guy in a motorcycle pulled up, and I wasn't sure what he was after, and it was only after gas.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Butler.
I just had one question for Kermit. So you've talked about all of this training is in the past. So from that, do I understand that all 106 Waymasters have this training at present?
No, they don't. After 2003, we have not received any additional training. We've had conflict resolution. How to deal with hostile customers is in development now because they had to develop a new program. So those things are ongoing and continuing because we'd have that anyway. The only thing that we were lacking is the pursuit one, which would be low speed. Basically what I described before is teaching you how to do lane changes at 55 miles an hour and 55 feet and how to wait and unweight your cars properly so you don't get into a predicament. And the stopping procedures.
I need a clarification.
Okay.
If you're doing all of this stuff, with the exception of lights and hand signals, at present, why did you stop? Why was the training stopped for everything else?
I can't answer that.
So, Madam Chair, want to understand, after 2004, they could continue to do most everything that they were doing previously, except use lights, and today we've denigrated the training down to the point where all 106 or most of the 106 would have to be brought back up to a level of DPSST training, which would bring them back up so that they could do all the things that they're presently doing and use lights and signals. Is that my
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, that's partly correct. The only part that we would have to have from BPST in order to fulfill what we're doing is basically the pursuit training, and we could have that done by an outside agency, say Columbia County Sheriff's Office, or, you know, another agency. Officer Mike Cobb here was a trained officer that can train us in a lot of our stuff. A lot of these things we could probably do in-house. We've done a lot of our training in-house.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The only other question I had was, it was asked whether they knew what California or Washington, what their policies were. Do you?
Washington used to have unarmed motor carrier officers. They have gone to armed officers. Those that did not qualify became bus inspectors. California is California Highway Patrol. The state of Idaho has motor carrier enforcement officers that are not state police and state police. The motor carrier officers that are non-state police that work in the scale houses have the ability under statute authority in Idaho to pursue bypassers. They do not work portable operations on the roads anymore. I'm not sure how they handle that function or whether they even do portable lanes out on the highways. But the motor carrier officers in the scale houses do have statute authority to pursue and bring back trucks that bypass. One of our officers quit and went to work over there. That's why I know these things. So basically, that Idaho is probably the closest state to in operation that we are.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Jack.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, here to talk to House Bill 3273 on motor carrier enforcement. ODOT is neutral on this measure. And let me give you some of the background as I understand it. Prior to April of 2004, as you've heard, it was the policy of ODOT to allow its motor carrier enforcement officers to stop trucks using overhead lights, to pursue them, principally if they've gone past the weigh station without stopping, and to pull them over. And that occurred up until April of 2004, when we received an advice from the Department of Justice that said a couple of things. Number one, that the statutes really are not clear that ODOT has been given the authority to allow its personnel to go after trucks and to pull them over with their lights. And number two, the opinion stated that there were some issues in that Attorney General's opinion regarding safety, and principally around the type of equipment that individuals are issued and the use of lights. ODOT vehicles have red lights on them. Police vehicles have blue lights. And the recommendation from the Attorney General was to take a look at least the issue of using, if you're going to pursue this as a policy, to take a look at the use of blue lights, which could communicate something different to the traveling public than does a red light. What is happening now is that, so ODOT stopped this practice back in 2004, and what happens now by policy, the policy is to, when someone goes past a weigh station, to either call the police, or if they're able to get identifying information on that vehicle, to send a citation to the registered owner of that vehicle. By policy, they're not allowed to go pursue a vehicle and pull them over with those lights. Right now, we're estimating there are about 1,700 or so of these incidents that occur a year. And as was stated, yes, this is something that happens infrequently. That's 0.05% of the time that somebody does that. So our position is, as an agency, should this decision be made to allow officers to pursue vehicles and pull them over, ODOT simply wants to revisit the safety aspects to ensure that individuals are safe, certainly their own personnel and the traveling public. And we want to look at the kind of training that's been discussed here and whether that's adequate and how that should be augmented, and also take a look at the vehicle equipment and what should be done with the vehicles to ensure that they're communicating the correct things, and if they're going to pursue and pull over vehicles with the lights, that they're properly equipped.
Thank you. I wanted to clarify a statement that you just made, and that was that they're not allowed to pursue a vehicle, and then you finished with and pull them over. So is that one statement, or is that
Chair Beyer, that is one statement. What happens now is my understanding that there are situations where someone can travel after a truck just to get identifying information and either phone that into the police or issue a citation in the mail. But the aspect of not being able to pull that vehicle over was what I was referencing.
Right. And also, maybe if anyone, I don't know if anyone, because there was Representative Butler, because I had another question, but I can't remember.
Thank you, Madam Chair. thank you very much. What's the nature of the citation that's written up? I'm a waymaster, and I'm in my pickup, and I've followed this person, got tags off the back end, gone to the front of it, got tags off the front end, driven alongside the door, and have gotten the name of the company off of the rig. What's the nature and severity of the fine that's issued, Jack?
Chair by Representative Butler, it is a Class B misdemeanor for running a way station, which is a situation where an individual, as I understand it, needs to appear in court, and it carries a maximum of fine of $2,000.
And the disposition, a follow-up, if I may, please. The disposition, there's 1,742 times this is happening. Tell me what happens to the 1,742 cases or actual follow-ups. What happens to those? How are they resolved in court?
Chair by Representative Butler, I can't speak to how they were resolved. This is simply a statistic that was captured from, I believe it was March of 05 to March of 06, that there were over 1,700 instances of trucks bypassing the scales.
So if the estimated incidences are 1,742, Could you tell us how many Class B misdemeanors have been resolved at some level by the department relative to the Waymaster's testimony that there is this number of blow-bys?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, let me just clarify your question. You're asking how many of these resulted in actual convictions and fines?
Yes, sir.
I do not know, but that's something I'll inquire about.
Thank you. I would appreciate knowing what the resolution of that is.
And I did remember my question. Thank you for filling the gap. This decision that this stems from, was this, where did it come from? Was ODOT just cleaning books? Was there a challenge? Do you have, clarify
Chair
that?
Beyer, it's my understanding that a citizen complained about an ODOT person pulling a truck over to talk about them using the wrong lane. And that person challenged the authority of ODOT personnel to be able to do that. So that led to the request for an attorney general advice, and that was rendered in 2004. And as a result of that, the policy changed that the thrust of that advice was that the statutes are unclear. And if you want to do this, pursue this policy of pulling trucks over with your lights, you really need to get that clarified in statute that you can do that. And number two, it raised issues about equipment safety and personnel training.
Representative Butler.
The equipment safety and personnel training brings up one extra item that I'd just like to quickly ask about. The testimony is from Kermit is that in Washington and California, basically, we've got gendarmes that are, hog leg carriers, well-trained policemen that are doing this. Any indication as to why those states feel like it's necessary to have better trained DPSST-trained officers handle these kinds of situations than we would by having our 106 waymasters just chase them down?
Chair by Representative Butler, I can't speak for those states. I know that recently they called around, well, in 2005, ODOT called around to states that do not use state police that have a similar situation to Oregon, and Colorado, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, South Dakota, Wyoming had Waymaster operators call the police rather than actively pursue vehicles. Idaho and Indiana at that time, well, station operators would pursue trucks but would call the police if the trucks didn't pull over. So I'm not sure what California is doing today with respect to this, but if they are using personnel in the same way we are, in other words, non-police personnel, to pull over trucks, we probably want to have that discussion with them if you decide to go forward with this policy to make sure that we can learn from them. I don't have information that they are indeed doing that, pursuing and pulling over trucks.
Clarification. You don't have information that they are pursuing and pulling over trucks in California using the State Highway Patrol, you mean?
Correct. The information we have, and this is from 2005, so this granted may have changed, was that California, along with those other states, use normal way station personnel, non-police personnel, and that they have a policy to not pursue and stop trucks. And if that's what I'm hearing is that that may have changed, so that's new information we'd want to take a look at.
It sounded different than the testimony that I gave them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. So I'm asking the same question I asked other people. So do you know of any accidents or other bad events that had happened when these folks had the ability to go after trucks and stop them?
Chair by Representative Tomei, and I'm going to give the same answer, which is no. But I will ask that question. I had not asked that question, and we'll see if ODOT has any information on that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We really appreciate it. Oh, yes. We had one more item on our agenda that was held over from last week, and we're going to go ahead and move them and hold them over until Wednesday's meeting. And we're going to do them first at Wednesday's meeting so they don't have to keep coming back. And thank everybody again. And we are, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3273, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.